stared through the curving smoke of his cigar. I doubt I will ever love again.
Good. You are, of course, allowed to love food and music and champagne and rare sunny afternoons in October. You can love the sight of waterfalls and the smell of old books. But the love of people is off-limits. Do you hear me? Don't attach yourself to people, and try to feel as little as you possibly can for those you do meet, because otherwise you will slowly lose your mind. He paused for a while. 8 years. That's the rule. That's the most an Alba can stay anywhere before things get really tricky. That's the 8-year rule. You have a nice life for 8 years. Then I send you on a task. Then you have a new life, with no ghosts.
I believed him. How could I not? Hadn't I lost myself after Rose? Wasn't I still, in a sense, waiting to find myself again? A nice life. Maybe it was possible. With a structure, with something to belong to, with a purpose.
Do you know your Greek myths, Tom?
A little.
Well, I am like Daedalus, you know, the creator of the labyrinth that held the Minotaur safe. I've had to build a labyrinth to protect all of us, this society. But the trouble with Daedalus is that for all his wisdom, people didn't always listen to him. His own son, Icarus, didn't listen. You know that story, don't you?
Yes. He and Icarus try to escape from the Greek island.
Crete.
Crete, yes. But their wings are made of wax and feathers. And his father,
Daedalus,
his father tells him not to fly too close to the sun or to the sea, or his wings will catch fire or get soaked.
And of course, both things happen. He goes too close to the sun. The wax melts. He falls in the sea. Now, you are not too high, but you have lived too low. It's a balance. I am here to help you get the balance right. How do you see yourself, Tom?
Not as Icarus.
Then who?
That's a big question.
It's a most important question.
I don't know.
Are you someone who watches life, or someone who participates?
Both, I suppose. Watching, participating. He nodded.
What are you capable of?
What?
Where have you been?
I've been around the world.
No, I mean, where have you been morally? What have you done? How many lines have you crossed?
Why are you asking me that?
Because, within the structure of the rules, you need to be free.
I was uneasy. I should have trusted that feeling, instead of just sipping champagne. What do we need to be free to do? He smiled.
We live long lives, Tom.
We live long lives. Long and secret lives.
We do whatever's necessary.
The smile became a laugh. He had good teeth, considering how many centuries he'd had them.
Now, today, hot dogs.
London, now. We live long lives, Tom. There is a tree in California, a great basin bristlecone pine, that was found, after an intensive ring count, to be 5,065 years old. Even to me, that pine seems old. In recent years, whenever I have despaired of my condition and needed to feel a bit more mortal and ordinary, I think of that tree in California. It has been alive since the pharaohs. It has been alive since the founding of Troy, since the start of the Bronze Age, since the start of yoga, since mammoths. And it has stayed there, calmly in its spot, growing slowly, producing leaves, losing leaves, producing more, as those mammoths became extinct, as Homer wrote the Odyssey, as Cleopatra reigned, as Jesus was nailed to a cross,
as Siddhartha Gautama left his palace to weep for his suffering subjects, as the Roman Empire declined and fell, as Carthage was captured, as water buffalo were domesticated in China, as the Incas built cities, as I leaned over the well with Rose, as America fought with itself, as world wars happened, as Facebook was invented, as millions of humans and other animals lived and fought and procreated and went, bewildered, to their fast graves, the tree had always been the tree. That was the familiar lesson of time. Everything changes, and nothing changes. I stand like a vertical headache in front of 28 14-year-olds, slumping back on chairs, playing with pens, surreptitiously checking their phones. It is a tough crowd, but I've had tougher over the years. This is certainly easier than playing to the drunken sailors, thieves, and drifters of the Minerva Inn in Plymouth, for instance. Everything changes, and nothing changes. The East End is a multicultural area, because it has always been a multicultural area, I say, as an opener to the lesson focusing on pre-20th century immigration. No one was ever a native of Britain. People arrived here. The Romans, the Celts, the Normans, the Saxons. Britain was always a place made of other places, and even what we think of as modern immigration goes quite a long way back. Well over 300 years ago, you had Indians who came here after being recruited on ships run by the East India Company. Then came Germans and Russian Jews and Africans. But it is true that, while immigration has always been a part of English society, for a long time, visibly different immigrants were treated as exotic oddities. For instance, in the 18th century, a man called Omai arrived here from the Pacific Islands. He arrived back on Cook's second voyage. I pause. I remember sitting on the deck of the boat with him, Omai, my old friend, showing him my daughter's coin and teaching him the word money. And when Omai came here, he was seen as so unique that every celebrity of the day, from the king down, went to meet him and have dinner with him. I remember his face flickering in the shadow of a flame. He even had his portrait painted by the most famous artist of the time, Sir Joshua Reynolds. He was a celebrity, for a time. Omai. Omai. I hadn't said his name out loud for a long time. Not since I'd spoken to Hendrik about him in 1891. But I often thought about him. About what happened to him. Thinking of him now, though, seems to add to my headache. Everything spins a little. He was... A girl on the front row, Danielle, chewing gum, frowns at me.
Are you all right, sir?
Cue laughter. Danielle turns around. Soaks it up.
Steady thyself.
I try to smile at the class. Fine. I'm fine. This part of London in particular has always been defined by immigration. For instance, over there. I point out of the window, westwards. Back in the 1500s and 1600s, you had the French. They were the first immigrants in great numbers of the modern age. Not all of them stayed in London. A lot went to Canterbury. Others went into rural areas. Kent. I pause.
Breathe.
Suffolk. But many based themselves in Spitalfields, and a real community built up. They started the silk industry here. Many of them were silk weavers. Many were former aristocrats who were suddenly having to make a new life for themselves in very different circumstances to the life they knew at home. There is a boy sitting on one of the middle tables. Anton. A quiet boy with a brooding and serious look about him. He raises his hand. Yes, Anton.
Why did they come here? I mean, if they had it so good at home.
Well, they were Protestants. Huguenots, they were called, though they didn't call themselves that. They followed the teachings of Jean Calvin, John Calvin. And at that time, it was a dangerous thing to be a Protestant in France, just as it was to be a Catholic in England. So many of them... I close my eyes, trying to blink away a memory. The pain in my head becomes too much. They sense my weakness. I hear their laughter flare up again. So many of them had to escape. I open my eyes. Anton isn't laughing. He gives me a small smile of support. But I'm pretty sure he, like the rest of the class, thinks I am not quite there. I feel my heart beat a frenzied jazz rhythm as the room starts to tilt. Just 1 minute, I say.
Sir?
Anton seems concerned. I'm fine, I'll be back in a minute. I walk out of the room, down the corridor. Past one classroom, past another. I see Camille through a window. She is standing in front of a whiteboard full of verb formations. She looks so calm and in control of the class. She sees me and smiles, and I smile back, despite my panic. I go into the bathroom. I stare at my face in the mirror. I know my own face too well to actually see it. Familiarity could make you a stranger to yourself. Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? I splash my cheeks with water. I breathe slowly. My name is Tom Hazard. Tom Hazard. My name is Tom Hazard. The name itself contains too much. It contains everyone who has ever called me it, and everyone I have ever hid it from. It contains my mother and Rose and Hendrik and Marion. But it isn't an anchor, because an anchor fixes you in one place, and I am still not fixed. Could I just keep sailing through life forever, feeling like this? A boat has to stop eventually. It has to reach a port, a harbour, a destination, known or unknown. It has to get somewhere and stop there. Or what is the point of the boat? I have been so many different people, played so many different roles in my life. I am not a person. I am a crowd in one body. I was people I hated, and people I admired. I was exciting and boring and happy and infinitely sad. I was both on the right and wrong side of history. I had, in short, lost myself. It's okay, I tell my reflection. I think of Omai. I wish I knew where he was. I wish I hadn't just let him go without trying to keep in touch. It is lonely, this world. Without a friend. The slow breaths get my heart rate down. I dry my face on a paper towel. I walk out of the toilets and back down the corridor and make an effort to keep looking ahead, to not look into Camille's classroom as I make my way back to my own, to act like a normal, non-shitty teacher with only, say, 40 years of memories inside him. I head back into the classroom. Sorry about that, I say, trying to smile, trying to be light, trying to say something amusing. I took a lot of drugs when I was younger. I get the occasional flashback. They laugh. So, don't do drugs. It can lead to a life of mental torment and history teaching in later life. Right, okay, on with the lesson. I see Camille again that day. Afternoon break. We are in the staff room. She is talking to another language teacher, Joachim, who is Austrian and teaches German, and whose nose makes a whistling sound when he breathes. She breaks off and comes over while I sit on my own drinking a cup of tea.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, I say. The smallest available word, accompanied by the smallest of available smiles.
Were you okay earlier? You looked a bit...
She searches for the word.
Intense.
I just had a headache. I get headaches.
Me too.
Her eyes narrow. I worry that she is trying to work out where she knows me from, which is probably why I say, I've still got it. The headache. That's why I'm just sitting on my own. She looks a bit hurt and awkward. She nods.
Oh, right. Well, I hope it gets better. They have ibuprofen in the first aid cupboard.
If you knew the truth about me, your life would be in mortal danger. I'll be fine, thanks.
I stop looking at her and wait for her to go away, which she does. I feel her anger, and I feel guilty. Actually, no, it isn't just that. There is something else, a kind of homesickness, a longing for something, a feeling I haven't known for a very long time. And when she goes and sits down on the other side of the staff room, she doesn't smile or look at me, and I feel like something is over before it has a chance to begin. Later that night, I'm walking Abraham back from the park via Fairfield Road. I don't normally go this way. I've avoided it since arriving back in London. The reason I've been avoiding it is because this is where I first met Rose. My ventures to Chapel Street and Well Street had been too painful, but I need to get over her. I need to get over everything. I need closure, as people say these days. Though you can never close the past. The most you can do with it is accept it, and that is the point I want to reach. I am on Fairfield Road, outside the illuminated despair of the bus station, putting my hand in a plastic bag to pick up Abraham's shit, then placing it in the bin. The history of London could be charted by the steady and consistent decline of visible feces in public streets. You know, Abraham, you shouldn't really do this on the street. That is why we go to the park, you know, that green place with the grass. Abraham feigns ignorance as we carry on walking. I look around, trying to work out where it is that I first saw her. It is beyond impossible. There is nothing recognizable. As with Chapel Street and Well Lane, not a single building that is there now was there then. I see, through a window, a row of people running on treadmills. They are all staring up at what I assume is a row of TV screens above their heads. Some of them are plugged into headphones. One is checking her iPhone as she runs. Places don't matter to people anymore. Places aren't the point. People are only ever half present where they are these days. They always have at least one foot in the great digital nowhere. I try to work out where the geese stalls used to be, and where she had been standing with her fruit basket. And then, I find it. I stand still a moment, with Abraham tugging on the lead as traffic whooshes by, oblivious. The headache ups a notch, and I feel dizzy enough to need to stand back against a brick wall. Just a minute, boy, I tell Abraham. Just a minute. And the memories break through like water bursting a dam. My head pulses with a pain even stronger than I'd had in the class earlier. And for a moment, in a lull between the sound of cars, I feel it. I feel the living history of the road, the residue of my own pain lingering in the air. And I feel as weak as I did in 1599, when I was still heading west, delirious, and ready to be saved. Part 3. Rose. Bow, near London, 1599. I had been walking near continuously for 3 days. My feet were red and blistered and throbbing with pain. My eyes felt dry and heavy from the short doses of sleep I had managed to steal beside forest paths and on grass verges by the highway, though in reality I had hardly slept at all. My back was sore from carrying the loot. I was hungrier than I had ever been, having had nothing in the last 3 days but berries and mushrooms and a small end of bread thrown to me by a pitying squire who passed me on his horse. But all of that was fine. Indeed, all of that was a welcome distraction from the intensity of my mind. The intensity seemed to have spilled out of me, infecting the grass and the trees and every brook and stream. Every time I closed my eyes, I thought of my mother on that last day, high in the air, her hair blowing in the wind towards me, and her cries still echoed in my ears. I had been a ghost of myself for 3 days. I'd gone back to Edwardstone a free man, but I couldn't stay there. They were murderers, every single one of them. I went back to the cottage and picked up Mother's loot and searched for some money,
but there was none. Then I left. I just ran. I couldn't be in Edwardston. I never wanted to see the likes of Bess Small or Walter Earnshaw again, just as I never wanted to walk by the Giffords' cottage. I wanted to run away from this feeling of terror and loss inside me, of infinite loneliness. But, of course, there was no running away from that. But now I was getting close to London. I had been told by a man with a lisp in the village of Hackney that if I was heading into London, I would pass by the Green Goose Fair at Fairfield Road in Bow. And there would be food there, and
various madness.
And now here I was, Fairfield Road. And there was the start of the madness. A cow standing square in the road, eyeballing me, as if trying to communicate something that was too easily lost in the chasm between animals and people. As I carried on walking, beyond the cow, there were houses on either side of me. And unlike in other villages, the houses just kept going on and on, in a straight line on either side of the road. There was hardly any space between them. This was London, I realized. And I saw crowds and crowds of people ahead of me, filling the street. I remembered how much my mother hated crowds, and felt her fear inside me, like a ghost emotion. And then, as I got closer, I noticed the noise. The competing shouts and cries of traders, the drunken laughter of the ale sozzled, the grunts and moos and hisses of assorted animals, pipes, singing, mayhem. I had never seen anything like it. It was chaos. The scene was made more intense by my delirium. There were so many people, so many strangers. Laughter flapped out of people like bats from a cave. An old red-cheeked woman sighing like a cart horse as she carried two panniers dangling from a wooden brace and loaded with fish and oysters. Two boys fighting near an impromptu pen of pigs. A pie stall. A bread stand. Radishes. Lace. A girl no more than 10 carrying a basket full of cherries. Roast goose stalls on both sides of the road. A lettuce lying in a puddle. An amused man passing me and pointing to a drunkard struggling to get back on his feet. "Two of the bell and mark him, boy! Whip cat tippled already!" Rabbits. Two live geese hissing and widening their wings at each other. More pigs, more cows. More drunks, many more drunks. A well-dressed blind woman being led around by a scruffy-looking orphan girl. Lame beggars. A woman coming in close to a random stranger, grabbing between his legs and whispering a drunken offer. The rowdy bustle around the ale stalls. A giant, "From the Netherlands," cried a man hawking the novelty, and a dwarf, "From the West Country," side by side, to maximize the money-making effect. A man swallowing a sword. A fiddler, a piper, a flautist, eyeing me with suspicion, with dexterous fingers playing Three Ravens. And the smells. Roasting meat, ale, cheese, lavender, fresh shit. The dizziness was back, but I kept on staggering forward. My hunger, presented with the scent of so much food, was now actually a kind of pain. I walked over towards one of the goose stalls. I stood there, inhaling the roast meat.
"How much is the goose?"
"3 shillings, lad."
I didn't have 3 shillings. The truth was, I didn't have any money at all. I staggered backwards. Stood on a man's foot.
"Mind yourself, boy!"
Boy, boy, boy. "Yes, I am a boy," I mumbled, even though 18 was positively middle-aged at that time. And that is when things began to spin. I was generally quite strong. One of the many quirks of my biology was that I was never really ill. I'd never had a cold, or the flu. I'd never vomited in my entire life. I'd never even had a bout of diarrhea, which, in 1599, was an incredibly, suspiciously rare thing to be able to say. Yet, right then, I was feeling dreadful. There had been rain earlier, but now the sun was out, and the sky was a hard blue. The same oblivious blue it had been above the River Lark. The heat added to the intensity of everything, which was intense enough to begin with.
"Maman,"
I muttered, delirious.
"Maman."
I felt like I could die, and in that moment I was perfectly fine with that. But then I saw her. She was standing holding a basket of fruit, frowning at me. She was about my age, but looked it. She had long dark hair and eyes that shone like pebbles in a stream. I walked towards her, staring in wonder at the plums and damsons in the basket. I felt a strange sensation, like I wasn't in my own body. "Can I have a plum?" I asked her. She held open her palm. I thought of Manning's hand and the outstretched fingers that kept my mother under the water. I saw the stray cow I had seen earlier, walking through the crowd. I closed my eyes, and my mother fell through the sky with the weight of timber. I opened them, and the fruit seller was frowning at me, cross or confused, or a little of both. I wobbled a little as the street sped in circles.
"Steady thyself," said the fruit seller.
Those were her first words to me.
"Steady thyself."
But I couldn't steady myself. I could see why my mother needed walls to lean onto after father died. Grief tilts you. Things went very light, and then very dark. The next thing I knew, a moment or 5 minutes later, was that I was lying flat on my front, half my face in a muddy puddle, surrounded by plums and damsons. Most of them were in the mud, too. Some were getting crushed underfoot by passers-by. One was being eaten by a dog. I slowly got to my feet. A crowd of boys were laughing and mocking me. The girl was scrabbling around on her knees, trying to salvage any plums she could.
"I'm sorry," I said.
I picked up a muddy plum and walked away.
"Oh! Hey! Oh! You!"
She grabbed my shoulder. Her nostrils were flaring with rage.
"Look what you have done!"
I thought I was going to faint again, and decided to keep moving, so I didn't do any more damage.
"Stop walking! You can't just walk away!"
I bit into the muddied plum. She grabbed it out of my hand, fast as a bird, and threw it on the ground.
"That basket was a week's money. A good week. Now I have to pay Mr. Sharp for fruit I never sold."
"Mr. Sharp?
So you can pay me now? I have no money."
She was red-faced with humiliation and anger. She looked confused about the money situation. Maybe it was because, despite the dirt on my clothes, and compared to most of the crowd around us, I was quite well-dressed. My mother had always made sure that, even though our circumstances had drastically changed since moving to England, we looked as noble as we could afford, which was, with hindsight, one of the many reasons we had struggled to fit in among the raggedy villagers of Edwardston. Not the main reason, obviously.
"That,"
she said, pointing to the loot on my back.
"What?" "Give me that. That can be your payment."
"No." She picked up a rock.
"Well, I shall break it then, the way you broke my basket."
I raised my hands.
"No, no."
She must have seen something in my face that made her think twice.
"You have no food. But you are worried about a loot."
"It was my mother's." Her face softened, went from anger back to confusion.
"Where is your mother?"
"She died 3 days ago." She folded her arms. "Yes." She looked around 18 or 19 years of age. I can tell you that she wore an ordinary white dress, a kirtle, as folk used to call it, and a simple red neckerchief worn at an angle, with the knot tied at the left side of her neck. I can tell you that she had very clean skin, a rarity among this crowd, and had 2 moles on her right cheek, one smaller than the other, like a moon in a planet's orbit, and a small constellation of freckles over her nose. Her dark hair was half inside a little white cloth cap, half free and wild. She had the kind of face that had spent most of its time frowning, but there was also a glint of mischief to her that played around with the corners of her mouth, as if a smile was always in the process of wanting to emerge, but being tightly regulated by some disapproving authority inside her mind. I can tell you she was tall, too. A quarter head taller than me at that time, if shorter than me when I became physically grown up.
Died?
Yes. She nodded. Death was nothing remarkable.
So, who do you have?
I have myself.
And where do you live?
Nowhere now.
You have no home?
I shook my head and felt the shame of it.
Do you play?
She pointed to the lute on my back. I do.
Then,
she said resolutely,
you will come and live with us.
I couldn't do that. A young girl came and stood next to her, with an identical but unbroken basket. It was the cherry seller I had seen further along the street. She looked about 10 or 11, sisters, clearly, the same dark hair and fierce stare. A drunk tried to grab a cherry, but she had quick reflexes and turned her basket away from him and made daggers with her eyes.
"This is not charity," said the older girl. "You will come and live with us until you have paid what you owe, for the fruit and the basket. And you can pay for your lodging, too."
The younger girl stared at me with eyes as direct as arrows.
"This is Grace," the older girl explained, "and I am Rose Claybrook."
"Hello there, Grace."
"He sounds peculiar and smells like a horse's arse,"
Grace said, unimpressed. Then to me,
"Where did you spring from?"
"Suffolk," I croaked, and very nearly added, "and France." But I sensed I wouldn't have to. Suffolk would be foreign enough. I felt dizzy again. Rose came to hold me up.
"Suffolk? You walked from Suffolk. We will take you home. Grace, help me hold him, and give him some cherries. It's a long walk in this state."
"Thank you," I whispered, as soft as the air, concentrating hard on placing one foot in front of the other, as though learning to walk again.
"Thank you."
And that is how my second life began. London, now. Maybe I had been leaning against the wall too long in the gentle rain. Maybe you couldn't be still any more in a relentlessly frantic city without the city seeking some kind of soft, unconscious revenge. I hadn't seen them approach. I'd been lost, thinking about Rose, feeling the intense story of the road. But I hear Abraham growl, and I look up, and they are there. 5 of them. Boys, or men, or something in between. They have stopped to look at me, as if curious, as if I am a sculpture in a museum. One of them, tall and gym-shouldered, comes close, in my face. Another boy behind him says,
"Don't be a psycho, man. Slate, let's go."
But the large one isn't going anywhere. He pulls a knife. The blade shines yellow under the streetlight. He expects to see fear in my eyes, but he doesn't. You get to the point, after everything has happened to you, that nothing can surprise you. Abraham growls and bares teeth.
"Set your dog on me and he gets it too. Phone and wallet. Then we go."
"You don't want to do this." The boy, he is a boy, I now realize, despite his height, shakes his head.
"Quiet. Phone. Wallet. Phone. Wallet. Now. We got things to do."
He looks around. The wet whisper of a car sloshes by in the rain. Keeps moving. It is then I recognize one of the boys, the youngest one. His face is half hidden inside his hood. He has scared, wide eyes. He is hopping from foot to foot, eyes darting, uttering words of panic under his breath, taking out his phone, pocketing it, taking it out again. It is the boy I had seen in class today, Anton.
"Leave him,"
he says, his voice muffled, backing away, and my heart breaks for him.
"Come on, let's go."
Time, I realize, is a weapon these days. Nothing weakens people like having to wait, in the street, with a knife in their hand. It's small, I say, referencing the knife.
What?
Everything gets smaller over time. Computers, phones, apples, knives, souls.
Stop talking, man, now or forever.
Apples used to be giant. You should have seen them. They were like green pumpkins.
Fucking shut up, you dead cunt.
Have you ever killed someone?
Fuck, man. Phone and wallet, or I slice your throat.
I have, I told him truthfully. It's horrible. You don't want that feeling. It's as though you become dead yourself. Like their death inhabits you. It sends you insane. And you carry it, you carry them inside you forever.
Stop talking.
My eyes lock with his. I press the invisible force of centuries into him. Abraham growls again. A growl that becomes a bark. He's basically a wolf, very protective. If you stab me, you just better make sure I don't let go of the lead. The knife trembles a little with the boy's fear. Maybe it is this shame of his own fragility, that makes him lower his arm.
Fuck this man,
he says. He walks away backwards, then fast, with the other boys following. Anton steals a glance back at me, and I smile and confuse him more. I understand. The way you can get caught up in things, find yourself floating, heading towards trouble you can hardly avoid. Hackney, near London, 1599. They didn't live in Bow. They lived further out, in a small, narrow house on Well Lane, in the village of Hackney. There were a lot of strawberry fields and fruit orchards in Hackney at that time. Compared to much of the areas in and around London, Hackney smelled quite inoffensive, and the air healthy to inhale, though it was very different to the countryside I had known in Suffolk. For one thing, there had been a theatre there. It had been dismantled a few months before I arrived, but Rose told me it had been wonderful, and that Richard Burbage himself had performed there, and Lord Brown the Bear. I don't know if it was the result of having a theatre, but Hackney seemed to be a more open-minded kind of village than Edwardston. There was no palpable fear of the outsider, well, except for a lady called Old Mrs. Adams, who spat at people she walked past, and often shouted, "Shit ass!" or "You walking hell turd!" at them, but people laughed it off. And that didn't really feel like fear of the outsider, so much as general hatred for everyone, which was at least a non-discriminatory attitude.
She spat on my apples once, and Grace went for her like a wild cat,
Rose said, the first time I was hell-turded, which was on my first walk to their cottage. Their cottage was a timber and plaster affair near a small stone wall that had its own overly ambitious name, the Great Stone Wall, and was a pebble's throw from a modest stretch of water known as the Great Horse Pond. The horses in question could mainly be found in a barn called, I kid you not, the Great Barn. There was another barn behind that, called, alas, Oat Barn. And beyond, there were the fruit orchards, with trees crammed close together for acres and acres. Further along was the stone circle of the well itself, tucked amid beech trees. To a 21st century gaze, it would all look quite rustic, but to mine, then, the various walled partitions of the land and the close proximity of the trees in the orchard made it seem a very modern kind of place. Rose and Grace had a deal with one of the local fruit farmers, whereby they would pick and sell the fruit of the season, plums and damsons and cherries, but also apples and greengages and gooseberries, and split the money they made unevenly in favour of the farmer, Mr. Sharp, a tight-fisted miser, who had cultivated the fruit. The cottage had more windows than I had seen in a house for a long time. It was nothing at all to what I had known in France, but it was a more advanced kind of lodging to the one I'd known in Edwardston.
So?
Rose asked me. She had a forthright look about her, a grown-up, take-no-nonsense look.
What is your name?
Tom, I said, which was the truth. But then I worried about the truth of me and how it was dangerous. So I lied about my surname, for for the first of many times. Tom Smith.
And so, how old are you, Tom Smith?
I had to be careful here. The truth, 18, probably wouldn't have been believed. And if it had been believed, then it would have been dangerous for her to know. And yet I simply could not tell her the age she most likely assumed, 13 or 14. How old are you? She laughed at me.
I asked you first.
I have 16 years. She didn't bat an eye at that. I suppose I was lucky in that when the condition took hold, I was already tall, thick-necked, and broad-shouldered.
Your eyes look older,
is all she said, which I found a marvellous comfort, as everyone in Edwardston had been convinced I was set in stone in my early teens.
And I have 18, she said, and Grace has 10.
This was fine, this talk. It was fine, but I didn't want to reveal any more.
I couldn't.
I was a dangerous secret. It was better for them not to know about me. They gave me a meal of bread and parsnip pottage and cherries. Rose's smile was like warm air.
You should have been here yesterday. We had pigeon pie. Grace is a master pigeon catcher.
Grace mimed catching a pigeon and twisting its neck. A moment passed. Then, inevitably, another question.
Why did you come here?
Rose asked.
You invited me. Not here. Why were you heading to London? On your own? What are you fleeing from?
Suffolk. If you had ever been there, you wouldn't even question it. It is full of pig-headed, superstitious, hateful people. We were from France, you see.
We never fitted in there. We?
I mean, when my mother was still alive.
What happened to her?
I stared at Rose. There are some things I would rather not talk of. Grace noticed my hand, the one holding the soup spoon.
He is shaking. He is also across the table, Rose said. You can speak as if he is here.
Then her eyes were upon me again.
I didn't mean to upset you.
If the price of this food and a night of comfort is to talk of painful things, then I would rather sleep outside in a ditch. Rose's eyes flashed with anger.
You will find Hackney has some excellent ditches.
I put down my spoon and stood up.
Do they never jest in Suffolk?
I told you I am from France, and I am in no mood for jesting.
You are a sour thing, aren't you? Curdled like milk.
Grace made a show of sniffing the air like a dog.
He even smells sour.
Rose was stern with me.
Sit down, Tom. You have nowhere to go. And besides, you must stay here until you have paid us what you owe.
I was a mess. I was confused. There was too much intensity inside me after 3 weary days of walking and grieving. I wasn't angry with these sisters. I was grateful to them. But that gratitude was swallowed up inside the pain of closing my eyes and seeing Manning's hands.
You are not the only one with sorrows in this world. Don't hoard them like they are precious. There is always plenty of them to go around.
I'm sorry, I said. Rose nodded.
That is all right. You are tired, and other things. You will sleep in the boys' room.
The boys' room? She explained it was called the boys' room because there had been 2 brothers, Nat and Roland, but they were both dead. Nat had died of typhoid when he was 12, and poor baby Roland had died of a mystery cough before his 1st birthday. This led on to an explanation of how their parents were dead too. Their mother had died of childbed fever, a common thing back in the day, a month after giving birth to Roland, which explained the baby's frailty, and their father had died of smallpox. The girls seemed quite matter-of-fact about it all, though apparently Grace often woke in the night, having nightmares about little Roland.
See,
Rose said, sprinkling salt on my shame.
Plenty of sorrows to go around.
She took me into the room. There was a little square window, about the size of a portable television from 1980. When I lived in a hotel in São Paulo in 1980, I watched a lot of TV. It made me think of the small square Hackney window.
The room was spare and modest, but the bed had blankets, and even though the mattress was stuffed with straw, I was so tired that the Queen's four-poster itself wouldn't have seemed any comfier. I fell on the bed, and she pulled my shoes off, and she looked at me, and the motherly sternness she had displayed before melted away, and she said, softly, as if to my soul itself, "It will be fine, Tom. Rest now." But the next thing I knew, it was the dead of night, and I was sitting up in bed, awake from the sound of my own scream, with a fat, full moon outside the window, and my whole body was shaking, and I could hardly breathe. Terror was flooding into me from every side. Rose was now there, holding my arm. Grace, behind her, yawned sleep away at the doorway.
"It is all right, Tom."
"It will never be," I said, half delirious.
"Dreams are not to be believed, especially the bad ones."
I didn't tell her the dream was a memory. I had to try instead to deny the reality of what I knew and dream up a new one, as Tom Smith. She sent Grace back to bed and stayed there beside me. She leaned towards me and kissed me on the lips. It was just a peck, but a peck on the lips was not just a peck.
"What was that for?"
I asked. I could just about see her smile in the moonlight. It wasn't a flirtatious smile. It was a plain, matter-of-fact one.
"For you to have something else to occupy your mind."
"I'm not sure I have ever met someone like you," I said.
"That is good. What point would my life have if there was a duplicate?"
There was a tear in her eye. "What's the matter?"
"This was the bed Nat slept in. It's strange. The space where he was being filled again, that's all. He was there, and now he isn't there."
I saw she was hurt, and for a moment I felt selfish in my own grief. "I can sleep somewhere else." "I could sleep on the floor." She shook her head and smiled.
"No, no."
Breakfast was rye bread and a small cup of ale. Grace had some ale too. It was the one drink people could afford that they knew wouldn't kill them. Unlike water, of course, which was basically Russian roulette.
"This is my house," Rose explained, "and the lease has passed to me now my parents have died. So long as you live here, you must live by my rules. And the first rule is that you will pay us what you owe, and after that you can pay us 2 shillings a week as long as you stay here, and help us fetch the water."
"As long as you stay here." It was quite a nice prospect, having somewhere I could stay indefinitely. And the cottage was a sufficient home, dry and clean and well-aired and smelling of lavender. A bunch of lavender, I now noted, stuck out of a simple vase. There was a fireplace for when the weather became cool. The cottage was a little larger than the one in Edwardston, with separate rooms, but the same level of care was taken to keep everything as clean and tidy and well-scented as possible. And yet, the offer of indefinitely staying there, if that is what it was, made me feel sad. I had the sense, even then, that there could be nothing permanent in my life from now on. You see, at this point, I didn't know things were going to change. I had no understanding of my condition. It had no name, and I wouldn't have known even if it had. I just assumed that was it. I was going to stay looking this age forever. Which you might think would be quite joyful, but no, not really. My condition had already caused the death of my mother. I knew I wouldn't be able to tell Rose or her sister about it without putting them at similar risk. And back then, things changed fast, especially if you were young. Faces changed almost with the seasons.
"Thank you,"
I told her.
"It will be good for Grace, having you here. She misses her brothers greatly. We both do. But if you cause any mischief, if you bring us into any disrepute, and if you refuse to pay..."
She held the moment like a cherry still to be swallowed.
"You will be out on your arse."
"In a ditch?"
"Covered in shit,"
said little Grace, having finished her ale.
"Sorry, Tom. Grace is her name, not a description."
"Shit is a fine word," I said diplomatically. It is quick to its point. There are no ladies in this house, Rose said, and I am no lord. Now wasn't the time to tell them that I was, however, technically a member of the French aristocracy. Rose sighed. I can remember her sighs. They were rarely sad sighs. They always had a sense of, this is the way things are, and how they are going to be, and that is perfectly fine, about them.
Good. Well, today is a new day.
I liked these two. They were a comfort amid the silent howl of grief. I wanted to stay, but I didn't want them to be in danger. They couldn't be curious about me. That was the main thing. My mother was thrown from a horse, I said, from out of nowhere. That's how she died.
That's sad,
said Grace.
Yes, said Rose. Very sad.
That is what I dream of sometimes. She nodded. She may still have had questions, but she kept them inside.
You should probably rest today. Restore your humours. So, while we go to the orchard, you can stay in the cottage. And tomorrow, you can go and play your lute and bring us money.
No, no, I will pay my debt. I will earn some money today. You are right. I will go into the street and I will play.
Any street?
Asked Grace, amused.
A busy one.
Rose shook her head.
You need to be in London, south of the city walls.
She pointed. She showed me the way.
A boy playing the lute? They will rain pennies on you.
Do you think so?
Look, the sun is out. There will be good crowds. It might give you new things to dream about.
And the sun shone through the window and lit her face, and strands of her brown hair turned gold. And for the first time in 4 days, my soul, or what I used to consider my soul, for the smallest sliver of a moment, felt something other than insufferable torment. And her little sister picked up her basket and opened the door, and the day streamed in, a slanted rectangle of light working its alchemy on the wooden floor. So then, I said, as if I was going to say something more, and Rose caught my gaze and smiled and nodded, as if I just had. London, now. It is 3 in the morning. I really should be in bed. There are only 4 hours left before I have to be up for work, for school. Yet, realistically, there is no way I am getting to sleep. I switch off the Discovery Channel documentary about Ming, the 507-year-old clam, which I was watching on the computer. I'm sitting here, staring at the screen. It probably isn't very good for my headache to be doing this, but I am resigned to it now. It is the curse of the alba, a kind of altitude sickness, but of time, not height. The competing memories, the jumble of time, the stress of it all, made these headaches an inevitability. And then, of course, being threatened at knife point hadn't helped, and seeing Anton among the boys had unsettled me. I go on the BBC and Guardian websites. I read a couple of news articles about fracturing US and Chinese relations. Everyone in the comments section is predicting the apocalypse. This is the chief comfort of being 439 years old. You understand, quite completely, that the main lesson of history is humans don't learn from history. The 21st century could still turn out to be a bad cover version of the 20th, but what could we do? People's minds across the world were filling with utopias that could never overlap. It was a recipe for disaster, but alas, a familiar one. Empathy was waning, as it often had. Peace was made of porcelain, as it always was. After reading the news, I go on Twitter. I don't have an account, but I find it interesting. All the different voices, the squabbles, the arrogance of certainty, the ignorance, the occasional but wonderful compassion, and watching the evolution of language head towards a new kind of hieroglyphics. I then do what I always do, and type the names Marion Hazard and Marion Claybrook into Google. But there is nothing new. If she is alive, she isn't using either name. Then I head over to Facebook. I see a post from Camille. Life is confusing. That is all it says. It has 6 likes. I feel guilty about how rude I was to her. I wonder, as I often do, if it is ever going to be possible to have anything resembling a normal life. Looking at Camille made me want that. There was an intensity to her that I could sense and relate to. I can imagine sitting next to her on a bench, watching Abraham, just sitting there, in the comfortable silence of a couple. I haven't wanted such a thing for centuries. I shouldn't do anything, really, but I find myself pressing like on her update, and even adding c'est vrai as a comment. The moment I comment and see the words there with my name beside them, I think I should delete them. But I don't. I leave them. And I go to bed, a bed Abraham is already asleep on. He is whimpering in his sleep. For years now I had convinced myself that the sadness of the memories weighed more and lasted longer than the moments of happiness themselves. So I had, through some crude emotional mathematics, decided it was better not to seek out love or companionship or even friendship, to be a little island in the Alba Archipelago, detached from humanity's continent instead. Hendrich was right, I believed. It was best not to fall in love. But recently, now, I was starting to feel that you couldn't do mathematics with emotions. In protecting yourself from hurt, you could create a new, subtler type of pain. It is a dilemma, and not one I'm going to solve tonight. Life is confusing. That is all we really know, I think, and the thought keeps repeating like a musical motif as I slowly fall into sleep. London, 1599. Bankside, in those days, was made up of liberties. A liberty was a designated area outside the city walls where normal laws didn't apply. In fact, no laws applied. Anything went. Any kind of trade could be plied. Any entertainment was allowed, however disreputable. Prostitution, bear baiting, street performance, theatre. You name it, it was there. It was an area, essentially, of freedom. And the first thing I discovered about freedom was that it smelled of shit. Of course, compared to now, everywhere in or out of London smelled of shit, but Bankside in particular was the shittiest. That was because of the tanneries dotted about the place. There were 5 tanneries all in close proximity, just after you crossed the bridge. And the reason they stank, I would later learn, was because tanners steeped the leather in feces. As I walked on, the smell fused into others. The animal fat and bones from the makers of glue and soap. And the stale sweat of the crowd. It was a whole new world of stench. I walked past the bear garden, called the Paris Garden for some reason I never knew, and saw a giant black-furred bear in chains. It looked like the saddest creature I had ever seen. Wounded and unkempt and resigned to his fate, sitting on the ground. The bear was a celebrity, a major draw of Bankside. Sackerson, they called him. And there would be many times I would see or hear him in action over the coming weeks and months, pink-eyed, clawing dogs from his throat, his mouth frothing with rage as the crowd roared in cruel and fevered excitement. It was the only time the bear ever seemed alive, when it was fighting off death. And I would often think of that bear and that pointless will to survive through whatever kind of cruelty and pain life chose to throw in his direction. Anyway, on that first day, I had followed Rose's directions, but I did not necessarily feel like I had come to the right place. It was far enough away from the noise of the soap makers, though not as far as I would have liked from a shit-smelling tannery. There were some people milling around. There was a woman in green, with a blackened tooth and coarsely powdered face, staring at me with some curiosity, as she leaned against the wall of a stone building with a painted sign depicting a cardinal's hat. This, as I already suspected, was one of the many brothels in the area. The busiest, it turned out, with a flurry of trade at any time of day.